This episode is brought to you in part by Zondervan, publisher of Ghosted, An American Story, written and narrated by New York Times best-selling ghostwriter Nancy French, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold. This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of The Overcomers, God's Vision for You to Thrive in an Age of Anxiety and Outrage, written and narrated by pastor and best-selling author Matt Chandler, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
This is CT Media.
Christianity Today, you're listening to Music and Meaning with Charlie Peacock. Welcome to a Q&A version of Music and Meaning, where I field questions from our listener audience. Joining me is one of my oldest friends and musical collaborators, musician and drummer extraordinaire, Aaron Smith. Papa was a rolling stone. You know him as the drummer on a huge variety of hit songs, including The Temptations, Papa Was a Rolling Stone, Romeo Void's A Girl in Trouble Is a Temporary Thing, and my own and DC Talk's version of In the Light. You ready, eh?
Ready!
All right, first question. Drum roll, please. From filmmaker and author Rebecca Bloom.
Hey, Charlie. Rebecca Bloom here. Wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions. First of all, on the topic of your songwriting, who is the you in Fine Way to Live Your Life, one of my favorite songs? I just would really love to know who you're talking to. What are you getting at? Second question is around covers. I love your cover of Long Ago and Far Away, the James Taylor song from Mudslide Slim. And I was just wondering to myself, how do you choose a song to cover? What do you look for? What are some of the songs that you haven't covered yet that you'd love to do? And lastly, which of your songs would you hope others would cover?
Thank you, Rebecca. Let's give the song a bit of a listen and see. The you is representative of the positive idealist, which I most often am until I get angry, anxious, and depressed. The observer, who is, I suppose, also me, assesses all the glass half fullness with the phrase, that's a fine way to live your life. And I think it is, with some other caveats mixed in, like critical realism and accounting for our differing personal freedoms and issues of systemic inequality. It's a bit ironic, though, I think, that I have this positive idealist respond with, it's a need satisfied. This little two-minute song seems to have scratched a common itch or felt need of people for a positive voice. I mean, it's one of my most popular songs on Spotify. Culturally, this makes a lot of sense to me, though, because in a time of extreme negativity and division, with two major wars being fought, leaning into a little bit of light is expected, or should be expected, I think, and history proves it, maybe even sought out. I know I'm seeking it out, not just for my own, but for our collective mental health. And I'm reminded of a passage from the New Testament book of Philippians, one of my faves, personal faves. Brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. So, fine way to live your life. As for Long Ago and Far Away by James Taylor, I chose that cover for a cover challenge back during the pandemic days. It's a lifelong favorite and one I've sung since I was 14. Artist Brent Bourgeois challenged me, and I in turn challenged Carole King's daughter, Louise Goffin. Her mother played piano on the original James Taylor version of Long Ago and Far Away. Here's a little reminder of my version.
To love is just a word I've heard when things are being said. Stories my poor head has told me cannot stand the cold. And in between what might have been and what has come to pass, I misbegotten guess.
Going back to my teenage self, I suppose another song I would cover would be Jackson Browne's Jamaica Say You Will.
Jamaica was the lovely one, I played her well. As we lay in the tall grass where the shadows fell.
Funny story about Jackson. I was in L.A. producing Holly Williams' album, The Highway, and recording Jackson as a guest vocalist on this super beautiful, moody bit of top-shelf songwriting from Holly, a song called Gone Away From Me. So pretty quickly into it, Jackson says, hey, I hear a couple of harmonies, but that's probably it. And I knew that Holly was looking for more of a duet with Jackson's classic voice prominent and recognizable. So I let him meander through the song once and then stopped him and pushed the talk back on the console.
Jackson, what if you were to answer a couple of lines such as?
And then I read him the lyrics. All right, let's try it, he says. Uh-oh, not what I was hoping for. It didn't have Jackson's personality, his special sauce. So I said, let's try it again. But he stops me and he asks me, just tell me what you're hearing. So in my head, I sang Jackson's song, Jamaica Say You Will, help me find a way to fill my lifeless sails and stay until my ships have found the sea. Then I silently reshaped the essence of that melody to fit Holly's lyric and sang the idea back to him over the studio talkback. And you can imagine that this took about, you know, 2 or 3 seconds in my mind. Okay, let's try it again, he says. Well, he sang it, and it sounded just like Jackson Browne.
There ain't no way, there ain't no way that'll ever be. You lie beneath that old tree. Gone away from me.
Gone away from me.
Gone away from me. Gone away from me. Well, I grew up in a town with one red light.
And as for covering my songs, oh my gosh, with AI, that has become limitless, fascinating, and super cringy. I admit I am partial to this version by this AI singer that goes by the handle Keys, which I assume is meant to suggest that it's like Alicia Keys. Check it out.
All you wanted was a life of bliss. May the sunshine, not the morning mist. It's not a fight, you know, to get your way. Take a breath, is what you always say. But could you live in more land of the winter, where there's no left or right, only metal? Dark of night, wooden light of day. To get well, there's more to pay. You say, let's play and be happy. You'd say, try to seek not to hide. I'd say, that's a fine way to live. You say, it's a need satisfied. Dream come true.
All right, next question. Drum roll, please.
G'day Charlie, it's Stuart here from Mobidge in South Australia. I'm always interested in the art of songwriting and how you approach it. So I guess the process may not always be the same, but how do you typically go about it? Do you sit down with a clear idea or a theme for what you want to say and then you follow that thought all the way until you finish? Or do you find that sometimes the idea comes to you and that you're simply the conduit for that idea? It's flowing through you and you find yourself, in a sense, compelled to record that idea. I'm especially interested in the process for when you wrote Monkeys at the Zoo and Kite in a Tree, two of my all-time favorite tunes of yours?
The short answer is yes to everything. Pretty much yes to every possible angle one could come at songwriting. But here's two of the most common ways that songwriters write. The first one is the melodic, rhythmic, and harmonic ideas come first and lyrics second or simultaneous as part of the whole process, which often sounds something like this.
In a typical Nashville songwriting session, there might be multiple songwriters in a room, but let's just say for the sake of example, there's two. And you might come in and visit for a bit and tell some stories, and sometimes you've never even met this person. So you kind of get to know each other, and maybe you ask, hey, any story ideas, anything that you've been wanting to write about? And then maybe somebody will suggest something like, hey, I was in the store the other day, and somebody had dropped a $20 bill, and I picked it up and returned it to them, and then they turned to me very surprised and said, wow, nobody does that anymore. And I thought, maybe that's a good title place to start, you know, and then maybe one of the other songwriters will have a guitar or piano and they'll start, you know, just kind of playing along like, and they'll just get something going like that. And they'll just sing kind of nonsense lyrics like that and get melodies going, and then the other songwriter will jump in. They'll have ideas too. And eventually something will start to emerge. You know, it might be just like, nobody does that anymore. Then some will say, yeah, but let's have a B section there. And then right? And you're just singing just vowel sounds and, like I say, nonsense lyrics until the lyrics start to emerge. And it's just this, you know, beautiful collaboration between a couple or more people in a room together, building a song from the ground up. And so that's the primary way that songs get written in Nashville.
The other way is lyrics first, a la the way Bernie Taupin used to write with Elton John. When I use this approach, I'm conscious that the lyric begins to suggest tempo and rhythm to me, and I'll start to hear a melody and chord changes. So by the time I sit down in front of an instrument, it's really more just about discovering the music that's been lurking within. Or I could throw out all those initial impulses and just begin combining lyric and music without any preconceived ideas. And I do that a lot as well. And here's an example of that.
I like to start with lyrics only, too. So I will write an entire page of lyrics or many lyrics, and in the process begin to hear what a song could be. And sometimes a song will have a time signature that it suggests or a tempo and so on. So let's say I'm going to be kind of a folk Americana singer-songwriter style in 3/4. So maybe I'll just stay on that B minor there. Steve snapped a frame, a rebel's disguise. My compass was spun and tossed. Iconic art for black and white, sign and symbol of the lost. Sign and symbol of inside my confidence, lost outside the city wall. I've been sick.
saxophone. You'll never know what God will use to place a call to save us all.
Now, as for Monkeys at the Zoo, my memory is that it was what you called something like a conduit song, right? So basically a song just kind of dropping in your lap. Maybe it's more inspiration than perspiration. And this plays into Leslie Frank's question too. Let's play that.
In Monkeys at the Zoo, it seems like you must have just been at a retreat or something else mountaintop must have been happening. Could you give me some background to it and what was going on in your mind when you wrote it? I love that song. I think everyone should listen to it.
Spirit, come flush the lies out. Spirit, come flush the lies out.
Once I had, here's the rub, nothing will ever take the place of the peace of God, I just naturally went straight to, Spirit, come flush the lies out. And then I just began repeating it as a prayer because I felt the tenderness of God for broken people, including myself, sometimes deceived by just a whole litany of sources, counterfeits, idols, seductions, all of that. And it was, as it has been many times for me, songwriting as prayer. And then Kite in a Tree was another prayerful song. It was written as a full lyric and then music. Here's a little sample of that.
Nickels, dimes, and dollar bills pile up in dusty corners. They smell like lonesome fields in the shadows of the day. There's a deeper river running, if only it would find me. Cut me like a canyon, wild and free. Shine that light in my eyes till I'm blind with vision. Lead me down to the river and drown me in the poetry. This is not the promise of the glory of kings. It's our breaststroke, no heart, no give and take delight. There's that pain in my chest that always comes on right before a big fight. If belief is only a construct, my own little thumb suck, then I'm a kite in a tree, a kite in a tree. If belief is only a construct, my own little thumb suck, then I'm a kite in a tree, a kite in a tree. I'm a kite in a tree, a kite in a tree. I'm a kite in a tree, a kite in a tree.
Today, songwriting is still as I've described, but there's also a completely other approach being used too. It speaks to the dominant influence of hip-hop and rap and electronic dance music. Though honestly, this approach began in part back when I was first experimenting with drum machines and samplers and computer sequencers at the advent of the 1980s. We created song-like tracks and then put melodies and lyrics on top of them. And this is the way, you know, my biggest co-write, Every Heartbeat by Amy Grant, was written in that way. But this new updated track approach to songwriting has its own common terminology, new terminology. For example, we used to call the songwriting producing part of using all the new technology, programming. probably because all of this new stuff was so closely related to computer programming. Now it's called beat making. So anything can be a beat. It doesn't have to be a traditional understanding of drums or percussion. But that beat becomes the foundation of a track idea, which a producer fleshes out and then others come in and collaborate on. For example, someone with a gift for melody, called a topliner, works on the track adding melodic ideas. And this is something that my son, Sam Ashworth, has done a lot of. These could be vocal sounds, nonsense melodies, or melodies with some or all lyrics already fleshed out or being improvised on the spot. There could also be multiple top liners and lyric contributors via freestyling a rap or writing, adapting lyrics for top line melodies.
Love is the rhythm I can dance to.
But the main producer sorts all of these collaborations out, picking and choosing and discarding, and the producer is generally one of the songwriters. A track in progress may even be passed on to another producer who contributes to it, and they get songwriting credit too. So, if you've ever wondered why contemporary songs have so many writers on them, like as many as 10 or 12 writers, this is the explanation. Here's an example of how this newer way of songwriting works in popular music. We'll start with a beat from my producer beat pack called Elements. Yes, this is a thing a lot of producers have. You'll hear me moving through lots of different choices. I'll assemble it, and then we'll send this beat over to Sam to do a top line on. He'll send the track back to us, and then that's what you'll hear next.
I don't know what else to do. Cause I'm not done with hope. I'm not done with love. Or anything good and true.
This is Andy Ashworth. I hope you're enjoying Music and Meaning, my husband Charlie Peacock's latest creative collaboration with CT Media. I love it, but wouldn't want it to overshadow our own good creation together. a brand new book we've co-authored titled Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much, The Way of Love in a World of Hurt. It's out now and available everywhere in book, Kindle, and audio form by Andy Ashworth and Charlie Peacock.
This episode is brought to you by Our Daily Bread Ministries, a global media organization that makes the life-changing wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to all. As a part of that mission, Where You're From is a podcast for those who believe it's important to stop and listen before we speak. Join us on each episode as we ask another Christian thought leader where you're from and discover how their life experiences and expertise, even if we may disagree with something they say, offers us important perspectives worth thinking about. To see our list of guests, visit whereyourfrom.org today. That's whereyafrom.org. I'm Russell Berry, reminding you that it's not just about where you're at, but it's also about where you're from.
Drum roll, please. And because these are somewhat related, I'm going to answer these two questions as one. First.
Hello, Charlie. My name is Alan Ward. I'm a physician in Great Falls, Montana, and Jocotepec, Jalisco, Mexico. Very interested in your early history. Would like to hear your first encounters with Saul Valentino.
And then Janelle.
I would love to learn more about your punk production. I have your Lie Down in the Grass cassette still. Yes, a cassette. But I was unaware of your punk work. Can you share some more about that?
All right, here we go. In the late 1970s, I made a choice to start playing my own music. I'd started co-writing with a visual artist and songwriter in Sacramento, California, named Stephen Dean Holzapfel. He co-wrote Keep This Heart in Mind for Bonnie Raitt, and he introduced me to attorney Maurice Reed, who owned Maurice's restaurant and bar for Sacramento artists, creative types, and I was a regular performer there, beginning in 1979. That was when I first started playing my own music at Maurice's American Bar. I sing a few songs like Springtime in Israel and So Sentimental.
Thought I heard a choir, but I was so torn down. Could have been anything, I suppose. Thought I heard a man on some plastic sax sounding just like Ornette in the 64. Yeah, but I'm so...
Mostly the band and I devised these sort of Sons of Miles Davis electric funk era improvisations. And blues harp legend Rick Estrin was there, jazz pianist Jessica Williams, Tower Records founder Russ Solomon stopped by, as would the Zen governor of California, Jerry Brown, and my close friends Steve and Pat Miner and Memphis singer-songwriter Bob Cheevers. They were always in the house, as was Joan Didion's niece, the sculptor Julie Didion. And I could count on these folks and a bunch of others to be there and champion my naive experimentations. The thing is that Maurice's was the perfect creative environment to develop as a young artist. Art was front and center, and it was there that I took my first baby steps as a solo performing artist. I felt safe. I'd found my people. Maurice's was also where Sal Valentino of the Beau Brummels first heard me. And for those of you who don't know, the Beau Brummels were a pop band credited as early architects of the 1960s San Francisco sound. And they were also produced by Sylvester Stewart, who would soon become known as Sly Stone. Here's a taste of the Beau Brummels.
Don't mind my preaching to you. I said, don't trust them, baby, now you know. You don't learn everything there is to know in school. Wouldn't believe me when I gave advice. I said that he was a tease. If you won't help, you better ask me nice. So be sincere, convince me with a pretty please. Laugh, laugh before I die. So funny to me. Laugh, laugh, you met a guy who taught you how
Sal took me around to meet various record company folks in Los Angeles. And so it was Sal and songwriter Steve Holzapfel that discovered me and got me going as a songwriter and recording artist. And I owe them both a huge debt. Sal also recorded a couple of my songs for solo projects, and I was in his band for a time. And our crowning moment was opening for Bob Marley. I didn't like the sound of my speaking voice back then, and so I affected it in a punky, new wave, Springsteen slash Elvis Costello sort of way, I suppose as a means of hiding from myself. And you hear it on that live recording of So Sentimental from 79. By the time I got signed to a demo deal with A&M Records in the fall of 1980, my producer, David Kahn, had helped me start moving toward my real voice. And you can hear that on this song, American Music. Maurice's was well located. I mean, Tower Records was right across the street, and so Maurice's was a natural stop-off and hang for a lot of bands, in particular the NorCal punk and new wave bands of the day. In 1979, I produced my first commercial punk record, a 7-inch 45 RPM single for the Sacramento art punk band Labial Fricative. More accurately, I co-produced with my Mad for Life friend, Steve Holzapfel.
They jumped next door, they pushed me too far. I told them once I won't take it no more. Disco, disco, all through the night. I'm going crazy, so we gotta fight. They jumped next door, won't push me no more. They hate my music, so they stole my guitar.
Though I did, in fact, wear a fur-lined motorcycle jacket, then, just like the song Big Man's Hat says, I was hardly a bona fide punk. I'm not sure Labial Fricative was either, with the possible exception of the lead singer, a 6-foot-tall bodybuilder and girlfriend to Mike Curtis, the bass player. One of my greatest co-productions, though, Daughter Molly, born in 1977, gestated to funk and jazz along with the punky new wave that followed in the wake of the Sex Pistols. At 3 years of age, Molly wore a button that read, "Shut Up and Dance," the title of a song by our favorite San Francisco punk new wave band, Pearl Harbor and the Explosions, featuring our friends Peter Bilt and John Stinch, which are today their actual names, Peter Dunn and John Haynes.
You just tell them, girl.
Fast forward decades, and the very rare Labial Fricative single is now selling for $200 plus. One blogger allowed that the band and its recording might qualify for a short list of Sacramento's fathers of the punk scene, along with Ozzy, the Twinkies, the Mumbles, and Permanent Wave. There's no good reason that Labial Fricative should have asked me to produce their single. Likely it was Steve that got us the gig. I'd done recording sessions as a musician, but I knew nothing about producing records yet. There you have it, the extent of my punk cred, but the actual start of my production career, 1979. Okay, Aaron, our last question. Drum roll, please.
Hey, Charlie. Greetings from Berlin. This is JR. I was wondering if you ever felt there was a time in your career when you were sort of at a crossroads with your dreams. Maybe it either wasn't really possible to make a living from your music, or it didn't really make sense to other people what you were doing, or maybe felt ridiculous to other people to keep pursuing your dreams, but you just knew you had to keep doing it because you felt it was a calling. Basically, how do you keep pursuing your dreams when they still feel either impossible or super far off in the distance?
Yes, I've known what it's like to have the people who love you most understand your dreams the least. And when I was first beginning, there was no one in my family, including my musician father, who had any hope that a teenage songwriter could develop to the point that the world would pay him well for his abilities. So I had to look outside my family for vocational encouragement. This meant reading lots of interviews and bios of songwriters and recording artists, then getting to know people who were active participants in the music business in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And then later in life, my dad came around because he realized he didn't know what he didn't know. And while it was very lonely at times, there were always people emerging who were eager to invite me into yet another circle of affirmation, which would then spin me up to the next circle, basically giving me just enough encouragement and work to keep pursuing the dream, which for me was never fame or money. It was always about being free to do the artistic work and do it well enough to provide for my family. So I had this expectation of recognition, but only so that it would lead to more opportunities. Nevertheless, for every yes, there was a no and some variety of opposition. Sometimes I was the opposition, just not getting out of the way of myself. I know you didn't ask this specifically, but in my story, monetization was the goal, and it was also absolutely necessary. While my dad was suspicious whether I could do well enough to provide for a family, you know, when I was a teenager, I got married when I was a teenager, and so I saw music as the only way I was ever going to succeed. I never let myself have something, as is said, to fall back on. It never entered my mind that I could create music as avocation or work under a different model, such as a gift economy or what Christians call simply bearing fruit or doing good for goodness sake. It just did not compute to me. This is where I'll pause for a moment and point you, JR, and listeners to several chapters from our new book, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much. It is out and available on the same day this podcast drops, March 12, 2024. JR, I recommend reading chapters 5, 6, 7, 14, and 15. These five chapters flesh out a ton of helpful ways at looking at your questions and answering them far more completely than I can do justice here. But I will add these thoughts. Number one, your work can be a gift to the world, regardless of whether it successfully competes by the world's definitions of success, or whether it is fully understood. In other words, good is not neutral. It always has additive, generative potential. This means that good is not bound to market goals. It's no less good if it's one of something or a million of something. Number two, not everything or everyone is meant to be easily understood or monetized or institutionalized or held up to metrics of success. In fact, some very good people and very good things start to splinter apart in integrity as you overorganize them, gut them of mystery, or try to monetize them. For example, you have unique skills and abilities, and these might be a beautiful gift to a small group of people, very ad hoc, casual. You provide them with something as a gift, or maybe you get a little remuneration for it too. But you're really making an impact, and this excites you, as it should. I have been there. So we give our projects more structure. We brand them, we get an elevator pitch, and so on. And sadly, this doesn't always make them better. It doesn't always make them grow in ways that people applaud or invest in them more. As an unintended consequence, this tinkering can actually suck the life out of them. And the people we were lovingly serving no longer receive our full, beautiful, undivided attention. It happens. Again, I know from experience. Number three, it's okay to dream seemingly unattainable dreams, especially prayerfully so. Aspiration and hope for good living and making are essential to good health, but so is assessment and discernment. As much as there is freedom in saying yes to dreams, when you discern that a dream is truly unattainable, there is great freedom in saying so, naming it so, then let it go and begin the process of grieving what didn't happen and preparing for what's next. I say all this with the caveat that when you least expect it, the dream may represent itself as attainable with all the resources needed, and I've experienced this as well. Finally, if we're going to allow for big, misunderstood, often unsupported dreams, then it would be dishonest not to allow for medium or small dreams, or in any way we might quantify or qualify our dreams.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong.
When I was a young musician, I used to like to play this song, The Impossible Dream, on my trumpet. It was very popular, covered by hundreds of artists, but the fave cover in our home was by Andy Williams. Here's the lyric. To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to rest. This is not just a well-crafted lyric. It is a meta-narrative for life, if you want it to be. Many citizens of Earth, especially artists, are fueled by this quest, this way of being, whether we know it or not. One of the extraordinary things about the wisdom of following Jesus as a spiritual practice and blueprint for life and artistry is this. We are free to dream the impossible dream and the possible dream. This is fully orbed freedom. My pursuit of the impossible dream may fail for a number of reasons. I lack the skill and ability. The timing is off. I got the wrong team members. Opposition is too great. People are indifferent. What I'm doing doesn't interest them, and so on. And as a Christian, I have to consider that my Creator knows more than I and simply does not encourage this particular dream into existence. If that happens, well, I will have learned some things in the process and reinforced the most important thing in all of life to remember. My failed attempts at realizing the impossible dreams have zero effect on whether God loves me more or loves me less. It does not affect my value or my identity. If I turn my attention to the possible dreams around me, which naturally tend to be long-sustaining, quiet, non-market-based dreams, like the quest to create good everywhere and in everything, I will immediately find a home and partners in this gift economy. For example, at our weekly Christian gathering, prior to the Sunday service, there are possible dreamers gathering and sorting diapers and food for the food pantry. It is quiet behind the scenes execution of a possible dream through a united community. The same is possible and necessary, I would argue, in the arts. As I've aged, I'm more convinced than ever that the artistic life is best lived when it includes the seamless integration of possible and impossible dreams. Thank you, friends, for these good questions, and thank you, Aaron, for your timeless artistry and for literally playing along. You're still deadly funky, I'll give you that. Hang on, let me jump in. Please continue to send any questions you'd like to hear answered on subsequent episodes to charliepeacockmusic@icloud.com. That's charliepeacockmusic@icloud.com. Use your voice memo recorder on your phone or something equivalent. Also, my wife Andy and I would love your support for our aforementioned book. You can pick up a copy, that's book, Kindle, or audio version, anywhere and everywhere. Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much, The Way of Love in a World of Hurt by Andy Ashworth and Charlie Peacock. Check the show notes for credits and information. You've been listening to Music and Meaning with Charlie Peacock, a CT Media original podcast. Until next time, practice reflection, stay curious, playful, and positive.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Lord of Spirits podcast. Many Christians yearn to break free of the influence of secular materialism and to understand the union of the seen and unseen worlds as made by God. What is the spiritual world like? Tune in wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you in part by the Table Podcast at Dallas Theological Seminary. Listen to rotating hosts discuss issues of God and culture to demonstrate theology's relevance in everyday life. Find it on your podcast app. For videos and more, visit dts.edu/podcast.